Benjamin Netanyahu reiterates warning to UN peacekeepers in Lebanon.
In fact, on the day that Israel began its ground operation next to our border with Lebanon, we asked them specifically, please leave this area so you're not harmed.
China surrounds Taiwan with massive military drills.
This, in a one single given day, marks the largest and most unprecedented level of Chinese military incursions and also operations around Taiwan.
And there are still undecided voters in the U.S.
You know, I just want to see, like, I want to understand who they are. They haven't really been involved much, and they're new to the entire political climate.
Today is Tuesday, October 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected accusations that Israeli troops had deliberately targeted UN peacekeepers in Lebanon, or UNIFIL as they're known, as completely false, and repeated a call for them to withdraw from combat zones.
The charge that Israel deliberately attacked UNIFIL personnel is completely false. It's exactly the opposite. Israel repeatedly asked UNIFIL to get out of harm's way. It repeatedly asked them to temporarily leave the combat zone, which is right next to Israel's border with Lebanon. In fact, on the day that Israel began its ground operation next to our border with Lebanon, we asked them specifically, please leave this area so you're not harmed. Israel is not fighting UNIFIL. It's not fighting the people of Lebanon. It is fighting Iran's proxy Hezbollah, which uses Lebanese territory to attack Israel.
He said the military did its utmost to avoid harming UNIFIL personnel while striking Hezbollah fighters, but the best way to assure the safety of UNIFIL personnel is for UNIFIL to heed Israel's request and to temporarily get out of harm's way, he said. A UNIFIL mission spokesperson said that its mission was more crucial than ever, and that UN peacekeepers in southern Lebanon are staying. As the cross-border skirmishes continue in Israel's north, the fighting in Gaza continues as well. Diane Toe of Reuters brings us up to speed.
Displaced Palestinians woke up to their tents on fire in the early hours of Monday after an Israeli airstrike hit Al-Aqsa Hospital in central Gaza. Medics reported several people killed and dozens of others wounded. I swear there's no safety, whether it's a hospital, a school, or any place, this woman said. Nearly 5 days ago, they hit a school, and today they hit the tents. As you see, what can we do? Israel's military said it struck militants operating from a command center inside the compound. It accuses Hamas of using civilian facilities for military purposes, which Hamas denies. The strike came as Israeli forces widened their raid into northern Gaza. Residents said the military had isolated several areas in the far north of the enclave, including Jabalia, Gaza's largest historic refugee camp. As strikes continued, medics were seen rushing wounded Palestinians to Kamal Adwan Hospital in Jabalia on Sunday. The Israeli military said earlier that it had ordered evacuations in areas including Kamal Adwan Hospital. 9 days into a major Israeli operation in northern Gaza, the Hamas-run Gaza government media office said Israeli strikes had killed around 300 Palestinians there. It said Israel's bombardment of civilian houses and displacement shelters was intended to force residents to leave Gaza once and for all, which Israel denies. Palestinian and United Nations officials say there are no safe areas in the enclave. They're also worried about severe shortages of food, fuel, and medical supplies in northern Gaza, saying there's a risk of famine there. An Israeli military statement on Sunday said forces operating throughout the Gaza Strip in the past 24 hours had attacked about 40 targets and killed dozens of militants.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us. Now to Asia, where China is holding its largest military drills ever, circling the island of Taiwan. It says the drills are a reaction to a speech given by the president of Taiwan last week calling for independence. For some context on the situation, I'm joined by VOA's William Yang in Taipei.
President Lai Ching-te, who came to power in May, gave a pretty firm speech on October 10th, which is Taiwan's National Day, that he repeated the message that China does not have the right to represent Taiwan. And that essentially, in China's eyes, signifies that he is once again highlighting the separate and independent sovereignty that Taiwan holds, rather than being a part of China. And then he went on to vow to continue to resist against the attempt to annex and also taken over Taiwan. He didn't directly name China, but the reference was pretty clear.
So is complete independence from China something that a lot of Taiwanese want, and is it something that they think is worth fighting a war over?
So more than 80% of the Taiwanese people prefer the status quo across the Taiwan Strait between Taiwan and China to remain the same, which is that Taiwan maintains its own system, its governance, its own currency, its own autonomy, while China also maintains its own, and both sides do not try to interfere with each other. But whether Taiwanese people believe that it is worth going to war for remains a very, very divisive question on the island, because for certain groups of the population in Taiwan, they believe that Taiwan should try to avoid using very clear and blunt languages like the ones that the president used during the National Day speech to try to provoke China, because they believe that maintaining a certain level of ambiguity about how Taiwan views the status of its own sovereignty is exactly the key to maintain the peace across the Taiwan Strait, because that's what Beijing also prefers. But on the other hand, there are younger generation of Taiwanese people who grew up in a Taiwan that they've always recognized as an independent country. And they are the ones that are very outright supporting the idea that Taiwan should be clear, blunt, and loud about the determination to defend its own sovereignty.
Well, intentional or not, it appears that China was provoked by the speech, and they've started massive, massive military exercises surrounding the island of Taiwan. Can you give our listeners a sense of what's going on there? How many ships, how many planes, what are you seeing, where is it, that sort of thing? Set the scene for us, please.
Right. So since basically 6 a.m. yesterday local time until 6 p.m. when the Chinese Defense Ministry announced the end of the one-day exercise, 125 Chinese military aircraft, including drones and helicopters, were spotted around the areas across Taiwan. And on the other hand, 17 naval vessels and 17 Coast Guard vessels were also spotted. And so this, in a one single given day, marks the largest and most unprecedented level of Chinese military incursions and also operations around Taiwan. The Chinese Coast Guard conducted an around-the-island so-called legal a law enforcement patrol, which is the first time ever that the Chinese has included its Coast Guard forces into a military operation around Taiwan like that. And yesterday's military exercise is not the first type of exercise that China is trying to simulate a blockade scenario around Taiwan, which is that they will be staging military drills in areas that are directly corresponding to the key seaports or other key infrastructures across around Taiwan. So this is basically a reflection that China is attempting to build up their capabilities and also demonstrate their capabilities of imposing a blockade, which will completely, essentially isolate Taiwan from the outside world.
Now, William, what was it like for you during the day? Could you see the Chinese ships and planes? Was there a sense that the country was under attack? Was it scary? How did life go on in Taiwan yesterday?
So life went on very normal yesterday across Taiwan. I think we need to also remember that China is very deliberately trying to manage how close they get within, you know, Taiwan's territory. They did push a little bit closer than previous military exercises, but it's still under the threshold that would be considered as an direct intrusion of Taiwan's territory. And so I and most of, probably all of Taiwan's citizens did not spot or recognize any Chinese military aircraft or naval vessels, but we did see the operation of those vessels through the videos that were released by the Defense Ministry.
VOA's William Yang in Taipei. William, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting today.
Thank you.
And back in the Middle East, Syrian rebels are facing a new threat from suicide drones. Rebels say the Syrian government and Russian forces have hit military and civilian targets with tactics developed largely by Russia in its war with Ukraine. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul with Mawaya Atrash in Idlib, Syria.
In northwestern Syria, on the front line between rebels and Damascus forces, a new danger looms. In recent images, another victim of a suicide drone attack is rushed to a hospital. This man monitors drone attacks for rebel forces and civilians in northwest Syria. Abu Amin is the nickname he uses for security reasons. He says Damascus and its Russian backers have deployed hundreds of small but deadly drones in the past year.
Russian forces transferred their experience of using suicide drones from the Ukrainian war to Syria. These suicide drones are launched from the front line through a joint Russian operations room with the Syrian regime forces.
Neither Damascus nor Moscow has commented on specific war tactics, but analysts believe such claims are well-founded. Samuel Bendit is a specialist on Russian defense technology at the U.S.-based Center for Naval Analysis.
They're not that difficult to put together. They're not that difficult to purchase. It takes just several weeks to learn how to fly those drones. And again, there's been years worth of experience now collected by the Russian military in Ukraine on how to use these drones that could be passed down to their allies.
Emergency responders are also the target of drone attacks, according to the volunteer group Syria Civil Defense, also known as the White Helmets. They say they often must wait until drones have passed to help bombing victims. Mohammed Al-Yassim of the Syria Civil Defense Group explains.
The danger of suicide drones is their accuracy, which delays our team's response to the bombings, as there is always a reconnaissance drone accompanying the suicide drones. They always send many suicide drones at the same time to the same place. This is what delays us in assisting people.
Farms also have been hit by drone attacks, and analysts say Damascus aims to undermine the rebels' local economies. Farmer Abdullah Al-Satouf says everyone lives in fear of the next attack.
On one occasion, a suicide drone struck near my house, and because it came early in the morning, my children were sleeping and woke up terrified, and someone's car near my house exploded. If the drone attacks continue, they will greatly affect the agricultural sector as we need many people to increase production, but everything will stop and no one will work if the attacks continue.
The rebels can do little to defend themselves from the drone threat, other than monitor their movements and issue warnings as Damascus seeks to crush the last center of resistance. Dorian Jones in Istanbul with Muawar Al-Trash in Idlib, Syria. VOA News.
Here's more stories we're following from around the world. On Monday, the World Health Organization announced it had received nearly $700 million in new funding and another $300 million in reaffirmed pledges during a financing summit in Berlin. The new financing mechanism aims to raise billions of dollars that can be deployed quickly and flexibly and hopefully save millions of lives. Canada and India expelled six of each other's diplomats on Monday, one of the most severe actions yet in an escalating dispute over the June 2023 assassination of a Sikh activist in Canada. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Canada was expelling the Indian High Commissioner and five others after police uncovered evidence of a targeted and worsening campaign against Canadian citizens by agents of the Indian government. Shortly afterward, the Indian Foreign Ministry said it was expelling Canada's acting High Commissioner, along with five others. Some good news for residents of the U.S. Capitol. Two giant pandas have left China and are headed for the Smithsonian National Zoo in Washington. It's part of a decade-long breeding and research agreement. The pandas, Bao Lai, a male, and King Bao, a female, are both 3 years old. International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Looking now at American politics, in the past month of U.S. presidential campaigning, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are both trying to reach the relatively small number of voters who say they have still not decided who to support. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns looks at the undecideds in this election.
Some Americans are already making their choice for president, with early voting underway in many states. But there remain voters who say they are undecided between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. New York voter Mary Beth Giovaccini.
You know, I just want to see, like, I want to understand who they are. They haven't really been involved much, and they're new to the entire political climate on both sides. They come from both interesting different backgrounds, and I want to see who they are and how they represent their candidates.
Undecided voters are about 3% of the electorate, according to public opinion polls. John Johnson is a research fellow at Marquette University's law school.
For a lot of voters, they haven't started paying that much attention yet. And so I think when you come up and ask them, that's the answer they might give. Some people also in the Midwest might be reticent to tell you who they'll vote for. So they could be some of that as well.
Targeted campaigning by Harris and Trump is moving some undecided voters, says University of Massachusetts political scientist Tatiche Nteta.
The population of the undecided voter is shrinking, and it shrinks with each day. Most people are going to make up their minds before Election Day, and what's really going to matter is going to be the on-the-ground mobilization of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And in what is likely going to be an extremely close election.
Trump and Harris have different challenges in convincing undecided voters, says Brookings Institution senior fellow Darrell West.
He needs to reassure Americans that, one, he respects the rule of law, that he's not going to be crazy and chaotic if he becomes a president. She, on the other hand, is less experienced. She took positions a few years ago that were much more liberal than the policies that she's espousing now. So she has to reassure voters that it's the Kamala Harris of today that they're going to get as president.
Trump, as the better known of the candidates, has both advantages and disadvantages when it comes to undecided voters, says Johnson.
Donald Trump is a candidate running for the third time for president, so most people have strong opinions about him already. And so of that sliver of people who remain undecided, just a single-digit percentage number of people, both parties are working hard to convince them to vote.
That's because those undecided voters could make the difference in close swing state races that will likely decide who wins. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
On the second Monday of October, since 2019, the U.S. state of California has officially celebrated Indigenous Peoples Day instead of the federally recognized Columbus Day holiday, which honors explorer Christopher Columbus and his mythological discovering of America. VOA's Genia DeLute visited the Indigenous Peoples Day celebration at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles.
Andrea Jimenez, founder of Herb Club LA, leads a garden tour at the Getty Museum in Los Angeles during a festival celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. She shows the visitors native plants to California. For example, yarrow, a flowering plant that is known for its medicinal properties.
So native peoples would use it for healing wounds, for healing indigestion, for healing, you know, all sorts of things. And it has been known as one of those plants that is called a panacea.
The third annual celebration of Indigenous Peoples Day at the Getty Museum drew about 2,000 people, making the event one of the biggest in Los Angeles, says festival founder Chelsea Anderson.
The mission of the Family Festival is to share resources of artists and makers from Indigenous diaspora in Los Angeles. We love the educational component of sharing traditions of the past, but also we really celebrate contemporary voices and contemporary artists.
One of the artists, Shigo Belilitso, a dancer with the Wild Horse Native American Association, says Indigenous People's Day brings recognition to his people who lived on the land before Europeans came.
I remember growing up, some teachers, they didn't even know we exist. Some people think we're extinct, and we're not. We're here, we're alive, we're well, and we're thriving. And we're passing this to our next generation, our singing, our dancing, our traditions.
The state of California does not observe Columbus Day, having replaced it with Indigenous Peoples Day in 2019. Solange Aguilar, a Native American poet, says growing up it was a struggle celebrating Christopher Columbus Day.
There's this story about him that he discovered America, but you can't really discover something when there are already people there. It's important to learn that history and understand that he was a really bad guy. He was awful. And those that history of him, that mythos or whatever, is a real thing. It's a real trauma that we carry.
Erica Barenwall, who moved last month to Los Angeles from Columbus, Ohio, is celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day with her family for the first time. She believes recognizing Native peoples will make a better future for her mixed-race kids.
That's important to us, for our kids to be able to grow up without people making so many assumptions about them based on the color of their hair, the color of their skin, their last name.
Columbus Day is currently a federal holiday in the U.S., unlike Indigenous Peoples Day, whose status varies state by state. On Monday, New York City is holding one of the biggest Columbus Day parades in the country, celebrating Italian-American heritage, culture, and achievements. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And finally today, NASA is set to launch a spacecraft to Jupiter's moon, Europa, which is considered one of our solar system's most promising spots to search for life beyond Earth. Reuters' David Doyle has that story.
Over the next 5.5 years, a NASA spacecraft, Europa Clipper, will make the 1.8 billion mile journey to one of Jupiter's moons. Its mission? To find out if life could exist in underground oceans of an ice-encased world. Europa is considered one of our solar system's most promising spots to search for life beyond Earth. Scientists have a keen interest in a vast, salty, liquid water ocean that previous observations have indicated resides under the surface of the moon. That's beneath an icy shell believed to be 10 to 15 miles thick. NASA planetary scientist Bonnie Baratti said, "There is very strong evidence that the ingredients for life exist on Europa." Baratti pointed out that there are three main requirements for life to form. These are liquid water, an energy source, and certain chemistry, specifically organic compounds that could serve as a food for any primitive organisms. Europa is considered to be an ocean world. Though it is just a quarter of Earth's diameter, it may hold twice the water of Earth's oceans. Europa Clipper has three main scientific objectives. They are gauging the thickness of Europa's outer layer of ice and its interactions with the subsurface below, figuring out the moon's composition, and determining its geology. It is the biggest spacecraft NASA has ever built for a planetary mission, larger than a basketball court. That's due to its sizable solar arrays, used to power scientific instruments, electronics, and its other subsystems. One of the 9 instruments on board is mass specs. It will sample gases to study Europa's ocean surface and atmospheric chemistries. It will, Baratti said, look for sophisticated organic molecules that could provide food. But there is a long wait for answers. Europa is expected to enter Jupiter's orbit in 2030, having used the gravities of Earth and Mars to slingshot its way through the solar system.
That's David Doyle of Reuters reporting for us, and that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.